In this episode, I'm talking to Sean Christy David. Sean believes everyone deserves an opportunity, and he's in the business of working with people who've not had opportunity, who've been denied opportunity, or have had it taken away. He's what we'd call a social entrepreneur. He runs a number of businesses that provide employment, opportunity, and in many other ways provide help and assistance and empowerment to people who really need that opportunity and that support. He has a long history of this type of work. He's worked with First Nations people, delivered initiatives in partnership with the federal government. He's been recognised by a variety of different groups for his work, including Time Out, where he was a hospitality future shaper. He was an AMP tomorrow maker, a Westpac change maker, and he has just been named recently in the Good Food Guide 2024 Awards as Innovator of the Year here in Sydney. Sean's the founder and CEO of Plate It Forward, and I'm sure you'll really enjoy listening to his story of his life, his beliefs, and his work. Enjoy this episode. Sean, welcome to the show, and thanks for giving up some of your precious time. Pleased to see you.
Thanks for having us, David.
Yeah, how have you been?
Yeah, it's been great. It's been a beautiful year. I think 2024 seems just a lot more positive. There's better energy in the air. People are going out, people are dining, and I just say people are happy when you walk down the street. I've got a hey, how you going? Which I haven't had all last year. So I think we're in a really great place this year.
Every time I see you, you've got a smile on your face, which makes it even funnier for me when I see references, as I saw one recently, to you as a former banker, right? You don't fit the mold as a former banker. And what was kind of an eye-opener for me, Sean, was I went back in preparing for this. I clicked on your LinkedIn profile.
Yeah.
And it said, you and Sean worked together at Perpetual in 2008. I'm like, that is a lifetime ago, right? But back then you were the typical kind of young person working in the city of Sydney, working for financial institutions, Perpetual being one of them, Macquarie, I know, was another one, Royal Bank of Canada, was it?
Exactly.
So you were on that kind of path, but there's an awful lot happened, I know, from your background before that and since that. So why don't you take us back to the start? Tell us a little bit about the young Sean and your family and your life.
Yep. I was 13 years old, and I remember my brother was 6 years older than me. He went for his first interview in the city, and I walked through Martin Place, and I saw the suits, and I saw the power, and I saw that. I went, whoa, I've got to be that one day.
So you're power hungry.
exactly right. Egotistical. But it was that, you know, from the western suburbs, we didn't see that. We didn't have people that looked like that. We all, my dad was a tradie. He wore overalls every day, blue overalls every day. And I think eventually he upgraded to khaki overalls by the end of his career. And when I saw that, I'm like, whoa, this is a whole new world. And I quite liked maths and things like that. So I started that as a career. Your subcontinental self, so it's a doctor, engineer, lawyer. I wasn't good at any of those things, not good at the sciences, not good at anything like that. So I thought finance was the way. And I enjoyed it while I was there, to be honest. But then I realized that it probably wasn't my calling and it wasn't my long term. I set up with good foundations, but I felt there was maybe barriers that I couldn't cut through at the time. Mm. And also, I was young. I was like 22, 23.
Mm. Yeah.
And I wasn't sure that I could be in an office all day every day for the rest of my life, to be completely honest. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't see that at the time, but it's become very apparent. Why didn't you think you could cut through or get past certain things? Was it an educational thing? Was it a you thing? Was it a background, your family? You know, was it a geographic thing coming from the western suburbs? What did you feel?
It was definitely the western suburbs. I felt mm-hmm. that. I felt different. I felt that I didn't have the same backgrounds that everyone else had. I didn't have that private school education. I didn't have, my family were tradies. My mum was, you know, my mum was kind of doing like childcare at the time and things like that. My dad was a mechanic. I just didn't feel that was my world. I didn't have the long-term connections that everyone else seemed to have. Their families knew each other. Their dads knew each other. They went to school together.
Yeah.
It was very clicky, and I was outside that clique. I remember one day I picked up a CV and was hiring someone, and a very senior person came behind me and said, wrong side of the bridge. She was from Cabramatta.
Yeah.
The girl's from Cabramatta, which is where I kind of grew up. And I hired her just basically because of that. but we just weren't there. And to the credit of the maybe the world, but also the financial service sector, it's come a long way since then.
Massive
improvements. The whole world's changed. The diversity's there. People are rising the ranks, which is great. I didn't see that happening in my lifetime, which is phenomenal to see changing. But yeah, I got out while I could.
That's an interesting way to put it. You got out while you could. Did you at that stage kind of think where you were going to go, or was it more getting out than getting in to something else?
It was a calling, actually. If I could say that, I don't know, like not a spiritual one, but I went back to Sri Lanka for the first time in 24 years. I went as an adult. We couldn't go back for so many years because of the war and being Tamil and things like that. But when I went over, I saw people that should have been me. I saw people that were exactly the way I looked. I'm a little bit taller than them, but they were so beautiful and so kind, but their lives were so different to my life. And that's when I realized what everything my mum had told me. I always say, my mum told me, you're not special, you're lucky. You're lucky to be born in Australia. You're lucky to have the opportunities you have. You're lucky to experience what you experience. And I didn't feel that till I went back, but then that calling really got me. I'm like, I've got to do something for the communities that look like me but didn't have that opportunity. So the whole pathway after that was building opportunities, building employment pathways, building educational pathways, building things so that people that didn't get the opportunities but are super smart, super incredible, super capable get that chance. And we've been lucky enough to build that for the past few years.
Before we talk about that, so that was a real awakening, I suppose. but you went back there with family, right?
Yep.
And I've heard you, before we talk too much about what you're doing in day-to-day,
yep.
I've heard you talk about your family a fair bit, and I sense it's very important. I sense your heritage is important.
Yep.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so my mum's an incredible lady. She's so smart. She's so brilliant. She's wise. She's a great cook, but she's very...
I've eaten your mum's food.
It's incredible, yeah. Yeah, was it a perpetual? I brought something. Was that right?
No, this was the event that you hosted down in Darling Harbour. And you had various people
doing courses, the Degustation for Change.
Which reflected their life and their...
Yeah.
Their ethnic background, I guess, and
that's right.
Yeah, that was great. We met your mum that
night.
That's
right.
So I got that sense that you hold her, very high regard.
And I think I hold my mum in the high regard, but I also hold women of that age and that experience and that wisdom. I always remember when you look at the numbers around education of women, you increase life expectancy. You decrease teen pregnancy rates, you increase community health outcomes, you increase so much goodwill in communities. And I think women do that. Women do that amazingly. And educated and mature women do that. My mum didn't have the biggest education, but street smart, very wise. And I look at the women that we've been employing, I look at their stories and their journeys. And that is why I suppose I hold my family in great esteem. I've got lucky enough to have two great brothers, who, as the youngest, you always say first born to set to rule the world and the last born's set to change it. And they gave me great principles. But yeah, I think it was knowing that we didn't come from a lot, but we never went without. Knowing that food was always there, that care was always there, that support was always there, that education, my mum made sure that we were educated, my mum made sure that we went to school. We're three boys from the western suburbs that have, my oldest brother's the CFO for a billion-dollar company. My other brother has a very successful mortgage broker business, and he's in the top 50 brokers in Australia and runs very successful. He just wrote his first book, actually, The Happy Home Loan, and he's able to go out there and do a whole heap of stuff in changing the mortgage broking industry. And the common denominator, it's not us, it's that mum who was there for us. So I think that's why we hold her, all three of us hold her in such high regard.
Well, she must be proud of what you've gone on to do because you've had that calling.
Nah, she still wants to get a proper job. She's like, yeah. When are you going to get a job?
But then there you go, right? You probably broke her heart in the paper the other day when you said that you were reported as being broke.
Yeah,
I did like it on LinkedIn that you then went on to say you're not quite sure that you like being broke. So you clarified that.
Yeah.
She's probably thinking, when are you going to get a real job, right?
She does. She actually tried to give me money that day.
Thanks. That says everything about your mom, doesn't it?
Exactly.
Okay, but beneath that, of course, I'm sure she's exceptionally proud because what you've done is amazing. And you're one of those people from my past, in the sense that 2008, 2010 period at Perpetual, that then resurfaces. I actually first met you at a Raise Foundation event when you were working there, and I was correct, helping them out.
Yep.
And since then, you know, every time I see you, it's something amazing. So you become one of those people that does great things, but also you seem to have a very big, a large capacity to take on a lot of things and do them at the same time and pull them off. And that's amazing. So I wanted to get into that. But let's just start with the basics. So tell people what you're doing in your own words. And of course, you're going to talk about Plate It Forward, which is the kind of main brand, I think, that you're known for now.
Yeah. Yeah. So I run what is called the Plate It Forward Hospitality Group, which is a series of, we call them premium social enterprises, trying to change the way that people see social enterprise. And so we've got four venues currently, which is Kabul Social, out at right around the corner from the Coda office at Wynyard Station, North Sydney.
Which is a fantastic feed, by the way.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? I'm going to go there for lunch now.
You don't come out of there hungry.
No. Ethnic women will feed you. We've got Colombo Social, which is my very first restaurant out in Enmore. And then we've got Keeve Social, which just opened up in Broadway, right next to Lansdowne. We do the food for the Sydney Swans, so we've got the Sydney Swans catering contract there. We have a centre for people recovering from addiction, where we feed people on their recovery journey 365 days a year, with high-end food to support their journey. And then we have a catering company which does office catering and things like that. That's probably our biggest company right now, for catering events, similar to the dinner that you went to. And then we have the charity, which donates about 2,000 to 3,000 meals a week. We've got a workforce of about 100 people. 90% of them are from communities where opportunity is not equal, and they would face barriers for employment or could not get jobs. So 90% of that, majority are women as well. We also run a program in youth detention. So there's a fair bit going on, where we teach young people to cook with celebrity chefs and employ them when they get out as well. So we are doing a bit. I think last year we consolidated a little bit, closed down some of the things that weren't working, and kind of looked at the less is more model. What can we do to fully support our staff and their families and things like that? So it's been challenging. Last year was a hard year in hospitality. Last year was a hard year financially everywhere, I think. So yeah, kind of wanting to make sure that every element and layer of our business creates a positive impact in the world.
Well, let's get into that in a moment. But yeah, I think it's going to be the case as we go through this. I'm getting several questions in my head. Really, let's just do short answers. Because I want to.
Sorry,
get to
I'm
no, close. No. That's exactly why you're here, right? You're here to talk. But I just think these are four things that came to mind that I hadn't thought to ask you. So it's just to roll through, get onto the other stuff. First of all, quickly, you want to change the way people think about social enterprises. How do you think people think about social enterprises, and what change are you trying to drive?
I don't think they think about social enterprises.
No, I don't either.
I don't even know what it is. I've got no definition. But I think you've kind of gone into charity. Charity experiences or social enterprise experience or whatever they are, and gone, I'm going to help people, and it's going to be shit. So it's going to be like a poor experience, but yeah, I'm doing something for the homeless, or I'm doing something for the needy, and I'm going to go out feeling good about it, which is the thing that we want to change. My staff are incredible. They're super capable. They're doctors, lawyers, engineers, pilots. We're not helping them. You know, they're helping us to change the way that we see the world. So I think that's the thing that we want to do. We want to be the first hatted restaurant in the social enterprise space in the world. We want to be the flagship.
That'd be cool.
Yeah, so that's what fantastic. We want to do. Yeah.
Okay, so this is more of an I'll ask it as a question. The way you've gone about that in a non-traditional way, one thing that struck me was when I came down with my wife to Darling Harbour for that event, you weren't asking for money. And that runs contrary to classic charity/fundraising protocols, right? You get people in the room, you get people to the event, and you want their financial support because you need it to run, right? You weren't naive. You consciously decided that's not what we're doing here. Yeah. And it was almost a kind of karmic thing of things will come out of this. Just explain to me, why do you have that approach? Because it's very unusual.
I I call it poverty porn. I think that the charitable sector has always gone out there and looked for, feel sorry for us. We are not great. And I hate it. I really, it irks me. I find it very disgusting as both a consumer, taking that media in, as well as someone that works in the sector. It downplays the strength of the people that we work with. As an organisation, to fund 150,000 plus meals per year, to fund supported employment for 100 people which has complex needs and things like that, and to do the work that we do in juvenile detention and a whole heap of stuff, we're 90% self-funded. So I fund 90% of the programs that we do.
Yeah.
I maybe could do it easier and ask for money, and I'm sure people would give it to us. But it's a statement of our power and our strength, I think. Also, I don't know how to ask for help. It's a very bizarre thing. That's why I'm still single. and every woman I've ever dated.
That's a good advert, mate.
Yeah,
one day you can be fucking me.
Exactly. Thank you. I'll give you my Hinge profile somewhere. But I kind of feel that it's just us trying to do something bigger. We want to change the way. I'd love to be 100% there. We've got a $200,000 shortfall this year, which we know we're hoping to kind of be able to fill pretty quickly. But our trade is what we want to focus on. We want to be the best hospitality experience, the best catering company, the best restaurants, the best thing. And that, therefore, allows consumers to come in a way that, and again, consumers have always got charity fatigue. You know, everyone's got charity burnout. What do I give my money to? What do I do? It's like, no, don't do anything differently. Just go to a restaurant. A restaurant and have the same experience, if not better.
So, so you're focused on quality, you're delivering a good product, and respect is really important in all of that, right? So that I think that's great. The other thing that you have done really well, and again, it came out of that event because you had someone there as a professional chef talking and helping with the cooking, of course. Something that's striking to me is you, without really coming from this world, you've managed to go out and get all these highfalutin celebrities and amazing people from the hospitality industry to give you meaningful help as opposed to tokenistic help. Yeah. You know, just the fact that you get any help from them at all from where you come from without that connectivity is pretty extraordinary. How have you done that? You say you're not good at asking for help, but come on.
Oh, look, I don't know how. I kick myself sometimes. I pinch myself sometimes because I'm like, oh, that's my favorite chef and we're doing something with him. Like, what? Like, I was on Instagram once and someone posted about some of the work we were doing. I'm like, hold on, man, you're Lennox Hastie, bro. Like, I love you. Like, I'm like, you. I sent him a message. I've gone out to dinner with him. One of the most incredible guys I've ever met. But he was my favorite chef. And he has Fyodor, and he's like, mate, this is it. I think what we've been able to do with the hospitality sector is get them together. We did a lot of support for the hospo sector during COVID when they were down. And I think this is just good karma being repaid. We gave free meals to hospitality workers. We did a lot of stuff. And we got the hospitality industry to change the way that they look at it as well, because they've always been asked to go out there and do these charity dinners that are like once a year, this, and that's it. And they flog their name off, and that's...
Yeah.
Whereas we're in the industry, we get it. We can connect on a way that's quite deep and personal. We took Nelly out yesterday to Redfern to cook for the community. We're doing a series every month with Concrete Playground, which you'll see hopefully soon. Where I'll take a different chef out there once a month with me to go out there and do charitable work. But they feel it. They feel it. Like, I took Dan Hong, Mitchell, Corey Costello from Rockpool, and all these incredible chefs out to juvenile detention, and they cook with the young boys in there. And they go out there and go, this is an incredible experience. So it's not a one-way street, which a lot of charity has historically been. You do for me and see you later, versus you feel this deep and meaningful.
Yeah, okay. So, look, it's, as I say, it's fantastic. But you've obviously got a gift for getting things done and a capacity to do multiple things. Tell people that wish they had those attributes what the secret is.
Just being a dog with a bone, honestly. I'm not a parent, and I don't know if I ever will be. I'm not sure. And that's neither here nor there, but I speak to every...
Better check out that Hinge profile.
Exactly. Yeah, it says no kids. But I think when I speak to my brother or I speak to all my mates about children, it's this sense that it's 24/7. It doesn't stop. It's hard. It's got this complexity. It's got this challenge. It's got this and this and this. But then my daughter will smile at me, or she'll hold my hand, or she'll say, I love you, Dad. And everything is worth it. Everything. Everything is insurmountable to that moment. And I think that's what I get. I get those moments of, like, far out. Like, today I was ready to throw my phone out the window. It was going off consistently. But then I'm going to go into Kabul Social after this, and I'm going to sit down, I'm going to have lunch with the incredible women there. And everything becomes okay. It just does. Mm. And when you see the progress and you see the growth, and you see, like, what we look at and what we measure is not the number of people, but the number of promotions, the retention rates. Oh, yeah. We've got a 97% retention rate across our marginalized community members for 2 years. This is unheard of anywhere in the world. So when I see those numbers and I see the people and I see the impact that we're having, everything just is like, you can't stop. You know, we know what's going on in the world. I know what's going on in the community that we're feeding. I went to Redfern yesterday and sat down and had lunch with 50 people in social housing, and they hug you, and they know, they remember bits about my family for years ago. They remember things that we've done for them 4 years ago. They'll tell me in great detail what we did. To me, I don't even remember that. Mm. But it stands out in their mind, and it's tattooed on their memory, and that's why I do it, I suppose, and it just keeps going.
One of the things that repeatedly becomes obvious meeting people like you is that the old kind of biblical thing of to give is to receive is true. If people work with purpose, I'm not trying to be twee here because this is called with purpose, but if you people are engaged in things that have a sense of purpose, they get so much from it.
Mm.
I've experienced that in my own career. I've been a massive beneficiary of that. It's helped me professionally and personally, you know, character-wise, etc. But I think you get a lot from it, but you bring to it yourself, I'm going to call it a natural energy. Maybe it's not natural because maybe it's about, you know, what fires you up, and we'll get into that in a second. But you talk about being a dog with a bone. I just think you're like a hustler, right? You're always trying to crack a deal. You're always trying to tie something up. You're always trying to secure the next thing for this group of people that you're trying to help and work with, right? And that drive, I suspect, is as much about you as it is about the work. So where do you think that inner drive comes from, Sean, that makes you a person that says you just can't stop?
You've met some of our staff. You've been there. You've heard their stories. You heard Hani's story. You heard my mum's story. You've heard the stories of our team. You know their background. These people have fled war zones. These people have sat in Christmas Island. These people have had. I have one lady who we gave a pop up to recently, and said, no, with her own business. That's our next goal. Who lost 57 people one night very recently. Overseas. When you meet these people, I've taken a commitment to them, and I've looked them in the eye and said, I've got you. No matter what happens, I believe in you. I've got you forever. And I've taken that very seriously. These are my family now. These are people that I fundamentally care about. They are super, super warm to me. You know, they invite me to their houses. I know them personally. And I've said, it's okay. I'll make sure you're okay. So to be able to do that, I've got to make sure that I set up foundationally and fundamentally forever. And this is why we go back to that question you asked about not asking for money. I cannot look at somebody and say, I've got you for the rest of my life if I'm contingent on funding, or I'm contingent on a donation, or I'm contingent on something. No, I've got to set it up so it's forever, that a movement will last forever, because I need to ensure that their children are safe. I was lucky because I was born here. My parents couldn't afford to send me to school. And then you mix education and empathy, and you build people like myself. I'm not a unique person. I've just been lucky enough to have the knowledge of a war zone, the knowledge of civil war, the knowledge of what hardship can be, but then mix that with great education. What we're doing today, I say the Play to Forward movement isn't a today thing. It's yes, we're feeding people that are hungry. Yes, that's an immediate thing. Yes, we're giving people jobs that would otherwise be sitting there and not being able to get employed, and some of them don't even have benefits. So that, where are they going? It's incredible what they're up against. But what we're doing is making sure that their children are safe and secure, because we're building the next generation of change makers. They see their mum going out there and having a great job, the head chef for a restaurant, and then they're going to school, and they've got a role model to look up to their whole lives. What they will achieve, and I'll never see this, we'll never see this, David. It's not about us anymore. But what these children will do for the rest of their lives and their careers, they will build communities bigger and better than we ever have. And what my legacy wants to be that is to make sure that we have given these children who are going to be incredible every chance at success to be better and do better. And that's the long-term vision of playing forward.
That's amazing. It's amazing. What about you though, Sean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you are all in. You just described the person who's all in.
Yep.
Right? Big commitment, ongoing, permanent commitment. And you can't stop. Mm-hmm. Right? Who looks after Sean? Because if it's going to work at some point, you know, you'd see yourself kind of retire, step back, hand it over. So there's all questions of succession. There's also questions of health, mental health.
Yep.
You know, you got to look after yourself. Yep. How do you do that? Or are you neglecting it like a lot of people do when they're just focused on other people and super passionate?
So it's probably the best question. Last year was dark. Last year was dark. It was a horrible place to be. I was ready to give it all up. The world had changed financially. People weren't spending. You're so intrinsically tied to the success of the business that when the business doesn't do well, it takes away everything that you ever think. I was in a dark place last year, I'm not going to lie. I had a very supportive partner who I didn't give her the chance to kind of be there for, because I couldn't accept it. So we broke up in a very horrible way, and then I started seeing someone else. And you see the ramifications of and the impact that you have on other people, which was a great realization that I've had this year. But yeah, it did get really difficult. I stopped working out. I stopped going to the gym. I stopped eating right. I was drinking a lot and things like that. And had so much pressure on me. But so I didn't look after myself at all. And then this year, after, you know, a very, very big wake-up call from someone that I love dearly and still care about, and she's like, look, I can't be around you anymore. Yeah. I think that really hit me and really changed the way I see things. And it's taken months after that to kind of realize that she was right.
It's I'm thinking of the classic airplane thing, you know, bring down your oxygen mask because you can't help anybody else unless you help yourself first, right?
Yeah.
There's an element of that. You just told a story that's actually pretty common. It's not a nice story, and thank you for sharing it. It's not an unusual story for people who are as driven as you. And they often, those things are the first thing to go, but they are the foundations. I think you were talking about that stuff around your legacy and what you're trying to build. You have to put the foundations in place. And I think the foundations for anyone, as they start to get older and they get more and more responsibility and they get really passionate about things and you get obsessive about it, you have to have those foundations, and those foundations include you being you know, healthy and you know, solid, right? Exactly. And that means looking after yourself, even though you're spending all your time trying to look after other people. Do you agree with that?
Everyone said it, and I thought that they were wrong, but everyone says that there must be some truth.
I suspect that's probably one of the secrets to your success, right? That often people say things and you go, nah, I'm just gonna go and do it, right? But in this case, I'm glad you listened, because I think it's really important, right? You can't, the other cliche, you can't sprint a marathon.
Exactly. It is, and you will burn out, you will fatigue, you will break a leg if you try to do that. I caught it too late, but I didn't catch it too late in the grand scheme of things as well.
Just later than you would have liked.
Yeah, later than I would like.
Later than ideal.
Yeah, and I think you start to see people get worried about you, and that's your telltale sign. So if anyone's out there doing this stuff, it's so hard to put yourself first, and I don't think you have to be selfish about it. But if you want the legacy to last forever, and you want your impact to last forever, and you want your purpose to last forever and be meaningful and deep and ongoing, you being sick or you being incapacitated or you not being able to do that stuff or not strategically thinking right will have massive ramifications for the whole thing, and that's where we got to look at it.
In the context of your work, I'm going to argue it's not selfish. If you have basically got a lot of people on a bus and you are driving that bus, if you as the driver of that bus is not physically and mentally in the place you need to be to drive that bus well, then that affects everybody, right? That's not selfish. That's just making sure that the thing that the bus depends on, which is the driver, is in the best shape possible, right? So I would argue that that's actually It's almost maybe a mental trick for you to say, when I invest in those things, being myself, actually, I'm still helping other people. That might make it easier for you to do it.
Anyway, yeah,
this is
turning into a counseling.
Yeah.
I've got my therapy. I've gone back to therapy. But no, it's hard because we've always been told to be subservient and to look after other people first. And that was a cultural thing. That's very much a Southeast Asian culture thing. So now it's just shifting that to recalibrate.
I'm arguing
a little
that it's
bit.
The same thing. I'm arguing that you are in service to other people by making sure that when you turn up to do your job, you're in the best shape you can be. Right. That kind of makes sense.
Yeah, you're 100% right. I think that's been the shift that I've had to go through recently to recalibrate what I've been told in a different meaning now, which is great.
So as you build the legacy, I mean, it almost seems crazy to be talking about your legacy. Of course, you're building it right now. Yep. But at the same time, it feels to me as if you've got so much more ahead of you. And every time I read about you or see you, there's something new kind of chapter has been added to the book.
Yep.
So what do you think, looking ahead, what do you think before you get to the stage where you kind of, you got the legacy and all your celebrity chefs are cooking your meals back at home in your palatial villa? What's next? What's the next at least chapter look like, do you think, Sean? What's coming up?
There was a massive period of consolidation, which has been great. And
at the business level?
At the business level, yeah. Looking at what works and what doesn't and getting rid of the things that didn't. So that was phase one. Phase two is growing the corporate catering and event side. I think that's a way that customers and people can get involved in a meaningful way, but also have great food. And looking at that has been a very big growth trajectory this year. It's been wild and great, and that's amazing. I think the next reiteration of Plate It Forward, we haven't spoken about this much, and it's very much what we've been building towards. I have a team of incredible women. I have a team of very, very smart chefs, cooks, business leaders. So we're going to be building an entrepreneurship program for these women.
You are a serial builder. It's very impressive. Yeah. Go on, tell us, what can you tell us about that?
I think with the caliber of people and their stories, their journeys and their talents, they should be business owners. But to start a business, as anybody knows, it's complex, especially when you don't speak the language, you don't have the history, you don't know IR laws and everything that Australia has that's great for us but complex for someone stepping in, as well as the complexity of opening your own business when you don't have trading history, things like that. So we want to give them the Plate It Forward brand, the marketing, the back office, the supply discounts, the credit terms. You know, we get 60-day credit terms, they'll get cash on delivery. They have to do payroll. I've got a whole payroll team. I've got all this stuff in the background. So we'll be investing in them. So we'll set up an investment fund where we will invest in them to go start their own businesses, and they'll be my business partner to go out there and have women-owned, culturally and linguistically diverse women opening venues with us, so that they've got a guaranteed. So I think what I want to do is, a lot of entrepreneurship programs throw the onus onto the person starting the business, and therefore they've got to be profitable from day one, which just doesn't happen, especially with complex women who are supporting families overseas, supporting families here, and doing a whole heap of stuff. So what we're going to do is give them a living wage up until the minute that it starts to profit, and then they take business ownership. So I'll give them a salary up until the point where, like, okay, cool, it's profitable.
Yeah.
Now you get equity in the company. So changing that so that they're not bearing the risk, and also going big. So it's not a market stall. It's not a little, you know, a little thing once a month. It's not that. It's like a bricks and mortar, proper restaurant, similar style that we go to. So we're going to set that up over the next year. We don't know what we're going to call it, but we're building something quite big, and we're taking women who would otherwise be excluded from the workforce and saying, no, not only you're excluded from you've got a great job, you're a business owner, and you're going to go out there and be the driver of the change, because we know when we employ women, the impact that has on society, what they're going to be able to do, but also changing the perceptions of Afghan women, Palestinian women, Sri Lankan women, Somali women, Yemenese women, who we don't know anything about their food or their culture, but we're like, no, here we go, you're going to be the ambassador of that, and you're going to go out there and change the world. That's the most exciting part of that. So that's what we're working on.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
As we kind of come towards the end, who are you who would you like, you know, given that you've got a chance to talk to people through this podcast, just kind of talk about who are the people you're really trying to shine a light on? Now, I realize you've just talked about those female would-be entrepreneurs and business owners, but who else through your work do you wish people knew better and understood, you know, in a deeper way?
About what we do?
No, I the individuals themselves. You're exposed to this group of people that,
yep.
To quote you from a speech when you won a recent award, they're the ones that should be up the front, but they're often not, right? They don't get the spotlight. You're working with these people every day.
Yeah.
Just kind of tell us about those people, I suppose. I'm inviting you to tell us about them and help us understand them, because we don't always hear about them in our daily lives.
Yeah. They're just strong. They're just intelligent. I remember, I'll tell you about one lady, Marina. She works at Keep Social. And I've been doing this for many years. I've interviewed incredible people. And I sat down across from her. She's in her 60s. And she hands me her CV. And her CV is, I was a chief economist for this huge bank in Ukraine. I have 25 years of leading 250 plus people teams. And I've been here for a year and I can't get a job, things like that. And we've got Google Translate going because she can't speak English. I cried during the interview. I said, I know what this job is. I can't do it to you. Look at your experience, look at what you've done. And she said, if not this, what? Nothing. And it broke me because that could have been my mum there. But like, you know, you've worked with incredible people in your time in finance. You know, you've got some of the biggest banks under your belt and financial institutions, and you've worked alongside very, very capable people. And for them to have to flee one day and then go somewhere else in the world and be looking at a restaurant job as a waitress at 60 years old, I mean, that's heartbreaking. And that's just one of 100 people in our organization. They've all got similar stories, and I think that what we would love them to know is that they didn't leave because they wanted to or because they're trying to chase a better life. They're leaving because they're trying to keep alive, and that the hardships and the things that they face on a day-to-day basis are really, really challenging. And I think that we've got to look at everybody with a bit more empathy, a bit more care, a bit more compassion. And understand that their life journey has been very, very good up until the point that they've had to come here. And that was eye-opening for me. And I didn't realize how hard that was for them. So, yeah, I think I look at myself and I look at if that was to be me far out, you know.
Yeah, that's a great insight. It resonates with me because it echoes conversations I've had, things people have said to me in the past, both on the podcast and through work, which gets back to the idea that we learn and benefit from being exposed to this kind of stuff. I think when you were talking there, for me, in part, what you were saying is, see these people as people. You're not an Afghan.
Exactly right. Yep.
You know, you're not a refugee. I remember someone who runs a refugee organization talked about them being people, not refugees. It's just a label. Likewise, we had a couple of guests on talking about homelessness, and they very subtle nuance but hugely powerful talked about how there are people who are homeless, not homeless people. Once you become a homeless person, that's you're defined, right? You cease to be a person with all of those that complex background, rich complex background that we all have. So I think you're encouraging us, correct me if I'm wrong, to see people as people, to take the time to understand them and realize that we all have these rich lives and our pasts may not be reflected in where we are right now. And you're obviously giving those people a chance. So I think just to conclude, unless you want to add to that.
No, that's why we do it through food, because there's a commonality and equality through food as well. A recognition of people go, that tastes familiar. So you are familiar. You are a person as well.
Yep. And you share food. Food is fundamentally exactly sharing
right.
things.
Exactly right. Yeah.
Look, I mean, these people, you're helping them. I think the final comment from me, Sean, is that what I admire most, apart from your business acumen, trying to get all these things done, is not that you're helping these people, but you're working with them and learning from them. And rather than trying to get them just a bit of help, you're actually committed to them for the long term. I think that's the bit that's really quite unusual, because a lot of times we're trying to help people in their present circumstances or give them a start. But my sense is, not just from this conversation as well, that you are committed to them as opposed to just committed to helping them for a period of time. I think that is a much more responsible way to be any type of entrepreneur, because entrepreneurs kind of start things and they move on, they start something else, and I often wonder what's left behind. But that commitment is a very responsible way to do it, and so I applaud you for that.
Yeah, it's not a 3-month program, 6-month program. There's no end date to our employment. There's none of that. Because everyone's got to be ready. You know, you've got a big organization. You don't say, well, I'm going to give you a job for 3 weeks and then see you later. That actually hurts people more than helps people. So it's when they're ready to do whatever they want to do, we'll be there to support them. But up until that point, we're there for them.
Well, I look forward to driving through the Western suburbs and seeing the big statue of Sean Christie Davis in 20 years' time, commemorating all your achievements. But in the meantime, well done. It's fantastic. Look after yourself as well as you look after everybody else. And I look forward to seeing all the great things you're going to do and having another feed down at one of your restaurants. Yeah. So thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having us. Appreciate you, man.
That's the end of this episode. Thanks for listening. For more episodes, go to the podcast page on codedcapital.com. You can also see there our other podcast episodes from the How I Did It series. And if you'd like to get some free insights for the charitable and nonprofit sector and for the broader investment sector, then head over to codedcapital.com insights page. Thank you.